So this is, we have these two classes this week. Did you have a good time bowling? Anybody went bowling last night? Clark, you didn't go bowling? Oh, you missed out. Anybody went bowling? Oh, just GSIs went bowling. You were all what? Studying Weber, right? Sorry, Elizabeth? What do you say? Somebody said something? No? Really?
I saw some undergrads.
They're not prepared to admit it. They're not prepared to admit they go bowling or they go drinking. Right, Neil, right.
Yeah.
Yes, we should hang you up here. Humiliate you once more.
It already happened.
Okay. You should ask him what happened. Yes. Okay, right. Very good. So, Weber today. Yes, Weber. Right, any questions here? Any questions before I begin? Okay, this prosthetic and spirit of capitalism, as I was saying last time, the most widely read piece of sociology, definitive piece of sociology. It is a classic. You've read it before, probably in Soci 1. Oh, I'm going to trip over that, but that doesn't matter. Okay. Look, we're only reading a tiny morsel of Max Weber, unfortunately, but we're reading it carefully and thoroughly, and I'm going to, you know, it's difficult for me to convey the enormous breadth and depth of Weber's writings, but anyway, I think you'll get a sense of it when we talk about more broadly about religion today. So what I'm going to do today is try and get halfway through the prosthetic and the spirit of capitalism and to get to the rationalization of religion. And so next time what we will do, if we don't get there today, is to really figure out the difference between, on the one hand, Catholicism and on the other hand, Protestantism, and within Protestantism between Luther and Calvin. These are crucial developments in what Weber calls the rationalization of religion. And there must be some Protestants amongst us and some Catholics, yeah? I hope so. Right, Jane? Yes, where do you put yourself? Yes, probably some sort of Protestantism, no? Yes, well, we'll see whether you fit with Luther or with Calvin or with neither. Anyway, so, all right, very good. All right, so that's what we will do next time, and then we'll talk about the relationship between the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Calvinism and the economics. A very interesting analysis Weber has of the relationship between Calvinism and economic conduct. And then there's a relationship between Protestant ethic and spirit of capitalism, and then we'll talk about the origins of reproduction of capitalism. And then we'll be done, and you'll be able to take a few days off to read the essay on bureaucracy. Right, Kristen, right? Okay, very good. All right, we mustn't waste any time. Summary. I really have to get through this today. Summary. Any questions before I begin? Gone. Right. Well, as I said, the introduction to this book was put there by a man named Talcott Parsons, to whom I have referred before, and he basically put what Weber thought his work was all about, as he just before he died in 1920. And so that's what this author's introduction is about. It's an overview of his work on economics and religion. And it starts out with that wonderful paragraph that we read out in chorus fashion last time. Yes, there you are, Andy and Sasha. Yes. We won't ask you to do it again. But the point of that opening chapter is to say there's something peculiar to Western culture, what he's going to call rationalism, something peculiar to it, and it has this peculiarity, has universal value. That is, it is a reference point for the entire world, and it has also universal significance in that this Western rationalism is having consequences for everybody on the face of this earth. And of course, we are the inheritors of that Western rationalism, the sort of capitalism that we are swimming around in now, which is very different to the capitalism Weber is talking about. But anyway, this Western rationalism has universal value and universal significance. So what is this rationalism? Well, it's something that invades all spheres of life, and he's reluctant to actually define it. But he talks about the way science, politics, law, art, music, architecture, education, all of these spheres of activity are subject to increasing coherence, internal coherence, and they are subject in many cases to a form of rationalism that involves developing the most efficient way to do things. It is something that we see is peculiar, Weber says, to the West. And it is above all expressed in MWBRC, which was Siena?
Modern Western Bureaucratic Rational Capitalism.
Only one mistake. That's not bad out of five. Very good. Bourgeois. You could have said bureaucrat. No, but actually it was not. It is important that it be bourgeois rather than bureaucratic. We'll see. Bureaucratic capitalism probably is something different. It's bourgeois rational capitalism. Talks about that on page 17. So what is this modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism? Oh, first Weber says, well, what is capitalism? Well, capitalism is the rational pursuit of profit. So that is the first and most simple definition of capitalism, the rational pursuit of profit. The rational pursuit of profit. That is the pursuit of profit through figuring out how to maximize revenue and minimize cost. Maximize revenue and minimize cost. It involves calculation. Above all else, it involves calculation and bookkeeping and involves money economy above all, because money becomes the vehicle through which we measure the revenues and the costs. So capitalism is the rational pursuit of profit. And there have been many types of capitalism in history before this modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism. And he talks about merchant capitalism. Now, merchant capitalism is a capitalism we discussed last time in which one gets profit by selling at a higher price than one buys. There are lots of merchants around here. Yes. So we have speculators who try and sell their shares at a higher price than they bought them and create havoc in the stock market. Merchants, speculators, capitalist adventurers, booty capitalists, pirates. Yes. These are all the different types of capitalism Weber refers to, but he is ultimately interested in modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism. And what distinguishes that from the previous forms of capitalism? Do you know? Rosa?
Is it the science behind capitalism? Yeah.
Yes. Part of it is the science, but the science is applied to what?
To making profit.
Yes, and how? What is peculiar to this modern Western rational bourgeois capitalism? Yeah, it does involve the application of science, but yes, Matthew.
Money becomes
an
end rather than instrument. Marianne. He's talking about how modern rational capitalism has three facets.
Ooh.
And it's a rational industrial organization of free labor.
Ah.
Action of business from home and rational double entry bookkeeping.
Wow. Wonder who that was. Ha ha. Well, yes. Have you got a page number?
I don't know where it is. 21.
21 to 22. Very good on the front row. Very good. 21. Yes. Right, underline this in blue. Okay, Monica, you got a blue blouse, so underline this in blue. Page 21, the new paragraph. No, the second new paragraph, where Weber says, what does he say, Neil?
But in modern times?
Yep, loud, so Sienna can hear you.
But in modern times, the Occident has developed, in addition to this, a very different form of capitalism, which has appeared nowhere else. Rational capitalistic organization of formerly free labor.
The rationally capitalist organization of formerly free labor. What is he talking about? The rational capitalist organization of formerly free labor. What is he talking about? Simeon, what is he talking about? Did we waste our time last semester? And it's not based on free, what is formerly free labor?
Labor that has an ability to seek different employers, I guess.
Yeah. Jessica, you had your hand up? Oh, you were, but you couldn't mean exactly the same thing. Slaves, absolutely not. Formerly free labor. Slaves are not formerly free. What does formerly free mean? It means that you are formerly free to sell your labor power to whom? Some capitalist. But you have to sell yourself to some capitalist, right? Formerly free. That's almost like Marx. Formerly, not truly free. Formerly free. As Simeon was saying, that formerly free represents the idea that you come with your labor power and you sell it to some capitalist. You've got to sell it to some capitalist. Otherwise, you do not survive. Formerly free. Formerly free. Not truly free, but formerly free. You are, you might say, enslaved to the capitalist class. But it's not slavery. It is modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism, which is the capitalism who talked about? Marx. Marx. Matthew.
So when Weber says formerly free, could it also be interpreted in the context of indentured laborers becoming free but being forced to stay at plantations, for instance, like Chinese coolie labor?
It could be, but we are trying to find what the core definition is here. Formerly free, that is you individuals sell their labor power, their capacity to work on a market. That is the core definition here. Formerly free. It's just precisely what Marx and Engels were talking about when they talked about capitalism. So this is the crucial thing, because when you're in merchant capitalism, booty capitalism, private pirate capitalism, there is not, the selling of labor power is not of the essence. It is selling things at a higher price. You steal something from somebody and then you sell it to somebody else. That's what pirates do. That's what colonialism was about. Right, Mike? Primitive accumulation. It's his favorite topic. Yes, but this is formerly free labor. Yes. Okay, very good. Right, very good, Marianne. Very good, very good. So yes, rational capitalists, let's put them up on the board. What did you say? Formerly free labor. So it's the rational capitalistic organization of formerly free labor. Yep. Separation of business from home. And bookkeeping. Yes, very good, very good, very good. What do all these have in common? The possibility of what? Calculation. Bookkeeping is not other than calculation. So advances in the mode of calculating costs and revenues. That's what bookkeeping was about. But what's the significance of separation of business from home? If you are there, what's the significance of separating business from home? Well, the significance is if you separate business from home, you can then focus on exactly what the costs of production are. You can, in a sense, insulate, isolate, and focus on exactly what the costs of production are. So that is necessary. So it's no good you... So this rational... Modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism is one that is really focused just on the productive activity, the production of surplus, based on what? Formerly free labor. Formerly free labor, the sale of labor power. The sale of labor power. This is indeed what he says on page 21, 22 is what Marianne was referring to, the bottom of page 21. He says, the new paragraph at the bottom, he says, rational industrial organization attuned to a regular market and neither to political nor irrationally speculative opportunities for profit. That's what the Bush administration was about. And irrationally speculative opportunities for profit. It's not, however, the only peculiarity of Western capitalism. The modern rational organization of the capitalist enterprise would not have been possible without two other important factors in its development. The separation of business from the household, which completely dominates modern economic life, and closely connected with rational bookkeeping. A spatial separation of places of work from those of residence exists elsewhere, as in the Oriental Bazaar. But what is peculiar here, as most importantly, is this idea of the rational organization of formerly free labor. Why is this so important for Weber? I know, Jessica, you've been trying to say something for the last 5 minutes.
So free labor, the free is referring to the freedom of like proletariat to choose who their masters or employers going to be, not like slaves are free to their owners, like the labor is free to them, right?
Right. It formally free labor is the idea that laborers have the possibility of choosing their employers, just as, of course, employers have the possibility of firing workers. That is very different from feudalism and slavery. We went through that last semester. Yes, Lauren.
So is it, because I'm still kind of confused, it's like freedom of choice, really?
Yes, formally free. They're in principle free to choose their employer. They can move around, but in practice they are... have to choose some employer. So they're not really free because they have to choose some employer. They have to be exploited by some employer.
Okay. Because like free labor, I don't know, to me, or like formally free labor, I still, it's like, if you're putting it on the market, it's like, it's not free. They have to pay you for it.
Formerly free. Oh, yeah, well, yes. There are many meanings of the word free. Formerly free. This is not to do with payment at all. This is freedom. Am I free or am I not free? Not, does it cost you anything to employ me as a teacher, but am I free, you know, to wander around up and down here? This is my freedom. This is a different... I'm sorry. Yes, Kristen, can you help me?
This would be helpful, but it's the illusion of free choice. It's like McDonaldization. If you go in, you can get, you know, a hamburger with cheese or pickles or whatever, but you still got to get a hamburger as the idea.
Very good, yes. You still got to get a hamburger. You can have all sorts of different types of hamburger, so you've got formally free choice, but it basically you come out with a hamburger, and they all actually, as you know, are just the same. Thank you, yes. But it's not to do with price. It's to do with this freedom, if you will, freedom of choice. But it's not to do with the price, formerly free. This is, and I'm sorry, Jessica, now I understand why you said slavery. This is not to do with the price of labor. This is to do with the freedom of labor. Okay, Sam?
Okay.
Oh, yeah. See, that was a formally free response. Now, I want a truly free response. Which would... What's your problem?
No, I'm
with it.
It's fine. I like it.
Oh, yes. Now it's truly free response. Yes. Right. Good. All right. But the question is for Weber is, why the harping on this formally free labor? Why is he going on about this formally free labor? Why is it so important for Weber? Why is it so important for Weber, this formally free labor? Why is it better to be formally free labor than it be slavery or serf labor? What is so good about formally free labor? Well, I'll tell you what's so good about it, because it is remunerated with a wage. So this is the price side. But the point is that formally free labor is a sale of labor power for a wage. And that means if it's sold for a wage, it's calculable. So many hours cost so many dollars. And not only that, if we don't need those laborers because we want to contract our business, we just fire those laborers. If we expand, we draw in more laborers. Basically, this idea of labor power, the sale of labor power for a wage, makes everything flexible and calculable for capitalism. That's why it is so central to Weber's definition of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism, because labor power can be sold for a price, a wage, and you can have so many hours, and it is at the discretion of the capitalist how many hours. Okay, so that is at the heart of the definition, but we do indeed have bookkeeping and also the separation of work from residence. The same point is that every aspect of this modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism implies the importance of calculation of costs. Yes. All right. Right. Now, the question for Weber is, where does this modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism come from? It is so peculiar. We have never seen anything like it, he says. Where does it come from? Where does it come from? And how is he going to answer that question? Well, that is the interesting thing. How are we going to answer this question? So, how are we going to formulate the question first? If you were thinking about the origins of this system, rational organization, capitalist organization of formerly free labor, what might you think would be the way to examine the question of where it comes from? What would you focus upon? You would focus upon perhaps where laborers come from. Where the working class comes from the proletariat. How do we get these wage laborers, right? How, you know, historically are they expelled from, expropriated from their access to the means of subsistence? But that is not Weber. Weber poses this and translates this problem of the origins of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism into the question of the origins of what? Hands up. Neil?
Capitalist punishment.
Yes, very good. Is it in there? You got the page number?
No.
No, it's nothing's underlined.
No, absolutely not.
It's amazing because you, Neil, are as brilliant as Weber. You don't have to read. You know all the answers.
I just don't underline.
You just don't underline. Ah, you don't underline. What do you do?
I take notes.
You take notes. Well, is there a page number where he says that really I am interested, therefore, in the origins of the bourgeois class? Does he say that anywhere? Or am I imagining it? Is Neil imagining it? Anybody? 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 Jamie Lou? Not yet. Greg? 23, 24, excellent, B, just two. In the last paragraph on 23, he says, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Nothing's okay. Okay. The last paragraph, hence in a universal history of culture, the central problem for us is not, in the last analysis, even from a purely economic viewpoint, the development of capitalist activity as such, differing in different cultures only in form, the adventurer type, or the capitalist, or capitalism in trade, war, politics, or administration as sources of gain, or on the stock market. Or getting bailouts from the government and using it for bonuses. No comment. It is rather the origins of this sober bourgeois capitalism with its rational organization of free labor. Or, in terms of cultural history, the problem is that of the origin of what, Greg?
Capitalistic organization of labor.
No. Or, in terms of the cultural history, the problem is that of the origin of... I'm reading from the text. Andy, can you help him?
The Western bourgeois class.
Yes! Is that of the origin of the Western bourgeois class and of its peculiarities? A problem which is certainly closely connected with that of the origin of the capitalist organization of labor, but it's not quite the same thing. For the bourgeois as a class existed prior to the development of the peculiar modern form of capitalism, though it is true only in the Western hemisphere. He is saying here that this peculiar form of capitalism that we have talked about in the context of capitalism in Marx, that Weber is characterizing as modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism, that we can think about its origins best if we think about the origins of the bourgeois class, because it was the bourgeois class that created this peculiar form of capitalism. So that is the project. Where does this Western bourgeois class come from? Yes. Right. Yes. So, what is Weber's answer? Well, that, of course, is the project of the book. So what essentially, if you were to summarize the rest of part of this chapter, is what essentially is Weber saying here is that he has these three forms of capitalism. So the wage labor, and that's the rational capitalist organization of formerly free labor. Calculation, that's the bookkeeping, and then there's the separation of home and work. But there's also three other features of this capitalism. That's not right. That's not a beautiful diagram. I think I'll do this differently. That's better. There are three other features that he talks about, that Weber talks about. Three other features that Weber talks about. Okay? That are necessary for this Western bourgeois capitalist class to appear. Well, he talks about, on page 25, I suppose. Yes. On 25, the... new paragraph. He says, among those of undoubted importance are the rational structures of law and of administration. For modern rational capitalism has need not only of the technical means of production, but of a calculable legal system and of administration in terms of formal rules. Okay, without it, adventurous and speculative trading capitalism and all sorts of politically determined capitalisms are possible. That, of course, has been suspended. It was a deregulated capitalism that got us into this economic mess because there was not the rule of law regulating the operations of capitalism. So you need a rational legal system which will regulate the relations among capitalists, much as Durkheim talked about it, and give some security and assurity, some sort of certainty to the capitalist engaging in these transactions with other capitalists, particularly competition. He says, without it, adventurous and speculative trading capitalism and all sorts of politically determining capitalism are possible, but no rational enterprise under individual initiative with fixed capital and certainty of calculations. You need such a legal system and such administration have been available for economic activity in a comparative state of legal and formal perfection only in the Occident. We must hence inquire where that law comes from. Among other circumstances, capitalist interests have in turn undoubtedly also helped, but by no means alone, nor even principally, to prepare the way for the predominance in law and administration of a class of jurists specially trained in rational law. So that's one feature. And then there is another feature he talks about, and that on page 24, he talks about the importance of science. As who was telling me about science? Was it Rosa? Yes, that's another feature. Why is science, as he says on page 24, so important? Science is important for what? In this rash... Yes, Juliana?
Optimization.
Uh-huh. And efficiency. And of course, science does what? It helps us innovate. Science helps us introduce new technologies, new sources of power, new ways of organizing production. So science is crucial too. So what he is saying is that these are five features of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism. Five features. But he asked, and this is the interesting question, in reality in history, these features have appeared before. So if you look to China, you find the development of science, to some extent some sort of rational legal order. We've even had wage labor in ancient Rome. We've had the separation of home and house. We've had bookkeeping. This has occurred in other parts of the world. But the whole configuration of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism has one other feature that has never appeared anywhere else. And what is this other feature that is a characteristic of this modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism? What is this last sixth feature that has really never been seen before? Aman. Yes, the pursuit of money for its own sake, the pursuit of profit for its own sake. And Marx will talk about accumulation. This is a very weird thing, Weber says. Weber says it's irrational. Why is he saying it's irrational? This making of money for money's sake, pursuing profit on his own terms. Why is it irrational? Why does he conceive of it as irrational? Jason, what do you think? Yeah, Jason. Why is making money for money's sake irrational from Weber's point of view? Do you think it's irrational?
I don't know. I just kind of feel like one is enough,
Yeah, you think it's irrational.
Kind of.
What do you think, Nick? Anyway, see, what Weber says here is this is a very strange phenomenon, this idea of pursuing money for its own sake. The idea, because normally what do you do with money? Spend it. I knew you'd know that answer. Yes, you spend it. You pursue economic activity in order to consume. And here you pursue economic activity in order to accumulate, to produce more and more widgets, more and more hamburgers. Hamburgers are all over the place. More and more. Don't eat any of them. Yes, and what does Weber call this pursuing of money for money's sake? It is the come on, Marianne, you must know this. No. Before you get to the Protestant ethic, before you get there, yes. No, well, that's part of it, but no, it's not. He has a special name for this.
Disenchantment? No, it's not a very difficult name. It is the Rachel? The spirit of capitalism. It is the spirit that lies behind modern Western bourgeois capitalism. That is to say, this pursuit of money for money's sake. Accumulation. Profit for profit's sake. The spirit of capitalism. These are the six aspects of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism. And the one he's truly interested in is the spirit of capitalism that is carried by the Western bourgeois class. Why are these capitalists so nutty? Why are they so crazy as to want to pursue money for money's sake? Money is to be spent, to use, to acquire things. Why do they pursue money for money's sake? That is the question that lies behind this book. Here we have the definition of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism, and the key feature that is new and is novel that really gives character to this modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism is its spirit, carried by the modern Western capitalists. And the question is why? And the answer is... Somebody gave it to me a few minutes ago. Somebody over here, I've forgotten who. Who said it? Marianne, yes. This is the Protestant ethic. Yes. So, that's essentially the argument of the book. That what is peculiar to modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism is the spirit of capitalism. And what Weber is interested in is how religion provided the foundations for the economic activity that we know as modern Western capitalism. How religion provided those foundations. Perhaps normally we think that religion is the opposite of economic activity, but Weber's life project was to try and understand what is the relationship, how different religions had different consequences for economic behavior. And he was particularly interested in how this spirit of capitalism was linked to Protestantism, the Protestant ethic. Okay? Greg?
And it's going against Marx's idea based on the superstructure. So instead of economic, that drives, the apparatus, it's now religion that's driving economic.
That's an interesting question. We are talking here about what? The origins of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism. The origins of capitalism. Does anybody remember how Marx talked about the origins of capitalism? Neo.
The feudal modes of production were fettered.
Yeah, the feudal mode of production were fettered, so that was the decline of feudalism, and then where did capitalism come from? The old production declined, but where did capitalism come from? Yeah. Well, it turns out that Marx had lots of different answers to this question. Of course, one answer was actually the expulsion of workers from the rural areas to the towns where they became wage laborers and they could be employed. But yes, so Greg, you're right that see, Marx was really not concerned about, this is very important, Marx was really not concerned about the past. He had different stories about the origins of capitalism. Different stories. But he was really interested in what, Greg? How capitalism would decline and give rise to socialism, communism. So he was interested in the future. Weber is interested in the origins of capitalism, and we'll see that when we get to the end of this book and we get to bureaucracy, his theory of capitalism itself is not that different from Marx's. But he was really obsessed about where this unique phenomenon came from. So that is why he went back and discovered these religious factors. Right? So in a sense, you might say that the superstructure did, you know, the superstructural elements did affect the economic base, but he's not yet talking about the reproduction, the maintenance of capitalism, the dynamics of capitalism. He's talking about the origins. So this is about the origins of Western bourgeois rational capitalism. The origins. It's very important that you distinguish between the origins and the reproduction. Origins of modern Western bourgeois rational capitalism. Okay. Is that clear, Greg? Yes. Yes. So, we have to be careful. You compare like with like. So if you want to compare with Marx, you have to think about... Marx, too, had an analysis of the way politics actually drove the origins of capitalism. But once capitalism established, it reproduced itself of itself. Economic forces prevailed. Yeah. Very good. All right. Any other questions? Yes, Juliana.
Where they are most divergent is in the German ideology, where Marx says that ideas are echoes, right? Like that's where more than the theory itself.
Yes, where. Yes, in as much as the German ideology is arguing that ideas and consciousness is the result of economic activity, he is not giving precedence to the central role of ideas that Weber seems to in talking about the origins of capitalism. That is true. That is true. That is true. That is true. But I want to insist really what is important about Marx is not the origins of capitalism, but the future of capitalism. So they're really talking about different problems. Yes, yes, yes. And even in the German ideology, do you remember that famous passage in the German ideology where Marx really recognizes the importance of ideas? Three B's for anybody who can do this. No? Matthew?
When he talks about the ideas of a certain class, or the ruling ideas.
Very good. Yes, he's one point. He talks about the ruling ideas in any society are the ideas of the ruling class. That's that one page he talks about that. And the ideas of the dominant class percolate down. It was like saw Gramsci's idea of hegemony, yeah. Yes. So he does, even Marx talks sometimes about the importance of ideas. Yes. Yes. Okay. But he doesn't really talk much about religion, actually, Marx. Yes, yes. Do you know what Marx said about religion? He said yes, 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 Lars. Opium of the masses. And what does that mean? Yes. Drugs, then. Yeah, yeah. Drug, drug, a drug. Opium is a drug, right? You take opium? No? Really? Oh, come on. Such a big bonger as you doesn't take opium. Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay, yes. Yes, the opium of the masses. In a sense, it's a... Yes, so this is not about... This, as you will see, the Protestant ethic is not an opium. It's not a drug. It's something that really so intensively activates people. Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Ian.
I'm sorry, can you think of science as a feature of modern Western capitalism?
Sorry, what's your question? I can get...
What you said about...
Oh, yes, science is important. Science is important for capitalism, modern Western, because science becomes the foundations for the invention of new technologies, for new means of power. You wouldn't have your computers if it were not for science, but these computers are the engine of modern capitalism. Science is responsible for accelerating the development of the what? Forces of production, yes. So that's what, Ian, that's what science is important for. Developing new technologies. Yes, Neil?
So you're saying there's something unique about Western Protestants that
Yes, and that's the essence of the book. When you read it, you'll see. Yes, yes, that's what we're going to talk about. Okay. There is something about this Protestant ethic. So really, we've got to figure out where this Protestant ethic comes from first. So, all right. So now we have to go move in a different direction. Well, first we've got to do two things. We've got to say, what is the spirit of capitalism? We're going to talk more about it. And then we've got to figure out how it's related to the Protestant ethic. These are our two tasks. One, two. So, all right. What is the spirit of capitalism? What is the spirit of capitalism? Yes. Yes. Right. Well, perhaps I should just read to you from... Yes. Well, has anybody got a nice page where he talks about the spirit of capitalism? Yes. Anybody know what this... All right, why don't we start on page 53. Where he talked about this capitalism as being irrational. On a new paragraph. Why don't you read it? Jason, number two, where are you? He's not here? What happened to him? He had to pick somebody up from the airport. Okay, well, Jason number one, must substitute.
In fact, the summum of this ethic...
The height of this ethic.
The earning of more and more money combined with the strict avoidance of all spontaneous enjoyment of life...
Oh, listen to that. More and more money combined with the strict avoidance of all spontaneous enjoyment of life. Aha.
Is above all completely devoid of any eudaimonistic.
Very good. Any pursuit of happiness.
Hedonistic admixture. It is thoughts of so purely as to an end of itself that from the point of view of the happiness of utility to a single individual, it appears entirely transcendental and absolutely irrational.
Yeah, this pursuit of money for its own sake appears to be so completely irrational. Nobody's seen anything like it before. It's irrational, pursuing money for its own sake. Money, after all, is to be used for consumption. Aha. Yes, and who? And who? Who represents this spirit of capitalism in this book? Who represents the spirit of capitalism in this book, class?
American.
An American by the name of?
Benjamin Franklin.
Who was a quite extraordinary chap, some of you may... Do anybody know about Benjamin Franklin? Some of your... Conrad, do you know about Benjamin Franklin? Do you know who he was?
Well, according to what we've been taught, he's one of the founding fathers and everything like that.
Yeah.
Others would argue that he was a quote-unquote gangster.
Gangster? Whoa. That's strong stuff.
Well, I mean, you know, depending upon whose perspective you look at.
Why do you call him a gangster?
Well, it also depends on your definition of gangster, too. Gangster-type activity, you know... doing certain things to individuals who are vulnerable, you know, taking advantage of people. He understands in that too. You look at the way in which he died with Aaron Burr and how it all went down, a shootout. I mean, you know, gangster activity.
That's a new vision of...
Depending upon how you look at it.
Yeah, what? Oh, very good. All right, what is gangster? Any other associations with Ben? Very good, very good. Any other associations with Franklin? Any other association with Ben Franklin? Yes, Charita?
Bifocals.
Bifocals. Yes, he was a scientist. Did he invent bifocals? Really? That's pretty impressive. Okay. Well, anyway, he was a great inventor, scientist. Invented bifocals. In those days, they had bifocals. Interesting. Okay, very good. I see. Gangster who invents bifocals. Very special. Yes, Aaron, what else do we know about Benjamin Franklin?
He was a French ambassador.
Yes, indeed. He was an ambassador in France. Statesman.
Provocative.
He was a gangster with provocative liaisons. That. Where did he talk about? Do you know where he talked about his not his liaisons? But where did he talk about his vision of life and how people should lead their lives? Yes, well, it was not only it was an almanac, right? Wasn't it called? It was an almanac of Poor Richard, right? Yes. So he had he wrote this for many years. He wrote it's like almost like a diary. Like he was what? He was the first blogger. He wrote this amazing almanac. Yes. So he had all sorts of. In reality, not only was he a blogger, he was a gangster. He was a scientist and an inventor. And he had awkward liaisons. He was a statesman. He was also a printer, a philosopher, a musician, and apparently an economist. He was, you know, basically he was. What would Marx think of this guy? He was living in the realm of freedom. He created it all around him. He had rich and varied talents in which he developed them all. But what is so interesting is that he was also has been seen to be, by Weber, who probably didn't know a huge amount about his life, he was seen to be by Weber as the prototype of the carrier of the spirit of capitalism. So let us, despite his gangsterish traits, why don't we look at page 51. Hold on. Oh, it's all over the place here, isn't it? Yes, 48 probably is where we should begin. Right, listen to this. This is Benjamin Franklin, page 48. These are these sort of mottos that he supposedly advocated that everybody else should follow. Remember that time is money, time is money. Okay, don't. Remember that credit is money. Don't misuse credit like you shouldn't misuse time. Every moment of your life should be spent productively. Right, Neil?
Absolutely.
Remember that credit is money. Remember that money is of the prolific generating nature. Money, if you work with it carefully, begets more money. Remember this saying, the good paymaster is lord of another man's purse. And dropping down a few lines. After industry and frugality, nothing contributes more to the raising of a young man in the world than punctuality and justice in all his dealings. Therefore, never keep borrowed money an hour beyond the time you promised, lest a disappointment shut up your friend's purse forever. Yes, AIG executives could read this. Page 50. Top of the page, new paragraph. Beware of thinking all your own that you possess. Beware of thinking all your own that you possess and of living accordingly. It is a mistake that many people who have credit fall into. To prevent this, keep an exact account for some time, both of your expenses and your income. If you take the pains at first to mention particulars, it will have this good effect. You will discover how wonderfully small, trifling expenses mount up to large sums and will discern what might have been and may for the future be saved without occasioning any great inconvenience. Calculate
tribulation for the purposes of saving. And then he says in the next paragraph, for £6 a year you may have the use of £100, provided you are a man of known prudence and honesty. Prudence and honesty. Isn't that funny? I mean, for £6 a year you may have the use of £100. I mean, tell that to the AIG executives. I mean, this is really, they are really not following honesty and prudence. They make money other ways. Okay, right. If you look on page 51, from the bottom, the top of the page, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 lines from the top of the page. Nick, why don't you read it out? Page 51. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 lines from the top. Truly. A peculiar ethic.
The infraction of this rule is treated not as foolishness, but as forgetfulness of duty.
Forgetfulness of duty.
That is the essence of the matter. It is not mere business as fruitless that the sort of thing is common enough. It is a duty. This is the quality which is true.
Right. So this spirit of capitalism is a, what would Durkheim call it? A moral fact or a moral rule. Yes, it is an obligation, a duty. It's not just a way of life, it is an ethical obligation, the spirit of capitalism, that one should in fact save. One should calculate, one should be honest, one should recognize, one shouldn't be frivolous, one shouldn't waste time. Time is money. Yeah, this is the spirit of capitalism. It almost is a sort of methodical control of an individual's life. So what is he comparing this to? Well, he's comparing it to economic behavior that is not this methodical regulation of one's life, but to what he calls the acquisitive instinct, the pursuit of money to satisfy material needs. So he says on page 53, under footnote 9, halfway down the page, he says, yes, into that second, into the first new paragraph, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 lines into, he said, man is dominated by the making of money, by acquisition as the ultimate purpose of his life. Economic acquisition is no longer subordinated. Now this is still talking about spiritual capitalism. It's no longer subordinated to man as the means for the satisfaction of material needs. Economic acquisition is no longer subordinated to man as the means for the satisfaction of his material needs. This reversal of what we should call the natural relationship, so irrational from a naive point of view, is evidently as definitively a leading principle of capitalism as it is foreign to all peoples not under capitalist influence. That for all peoples not under the influence of this modern Western capitalism, we are pursue money in order to acquire things. We pursue acquisitiveness. We are acquisitive people. But the point is that the spirit of capitalism is to be contrasted with acquisitiveness. So we have the spirit of capitalism as opposed to the acquisitive instinct, in which the point is to consume. Acquisitive instinct, to acquire more and more things. And the second contrast is what? Is behavior that is not in the pursuit of consumption, but in the pursuit, well, it's not pursuit of anything, it's what he calls traditionalism. What is traditionalist economic behavior? What is traditionalist economic behavior? What would you think, Aaron?
It's where a person is fine with just their traditional means of existence. If you give them more money per hour, they won't necessarily work more, so
it's fewer hours. That's right. That's right. So what the point of this argument here is that the spirit of capitalism leads people to pursue more and more money for money's sake.
to increasingly invent new ways of making money, of accumulating more and more, whereas the traditionalist is happy with the way things are. So if you pay somebody more, as Aaron says, if you give them a higher wage, they will work fewer hours. They have a traditionalist expectation, a customary expectation of how much they need to live. Yes, and he has all sorts of interesting things to say about that. Does anybody pick up on that? 60, very good, Jamie Lou. Yes, 60. Very good. On page 60, for example, very good. 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines down. 8 lines down. Sam, why don't you read it out? You don't have your reader. Now, what would Benjamin Franklin think about that? You're a gangster? Time is money. Don't dawdle. You should be methodically controlling your life, Sam. How can you not bring the reader? What sort of spirit inspires you? Oh, yes. See, that's the Catholic response. I'm sorry. We'll see what the Protestant response is. Okay, yes. Right, you ready? Page 60, 2, 4, 6, 8 lines down.
A man does not, by nature, wish to earn more and more money, but simply to live as he is accustomed to live, and to earn as much as is necessary for that purpose. Wherever modern capitalism has begun, its work of increasing the productivity of human labor by increasing its intensity, it has encountered the immensely stubborn resistance of this leading trait of pre-capitalistic labor. And today, it encounters it more. The more backward, from a capitalistic point of view, the laboring forces are with which it has to deal.
So there are all these laborers who are not imbued with the spirit of capitalism, who really just want to have things the way they always were. And he particularly criticizes who? Does anybody pick up on that, who he criticizes? Yes, Maryam?
Women.
Women! Where do you find women? Page 62. Yes. Well, I'm not going to read. You can read that for yourselves. Well, he says on page 62, the new paragraph, he says, what is meant can again best be explained by means of example. The type of backward traditional form of labor is today very often exemplified by women workers, especially unmarried ones. An almost universal complaint of employers of girls, for instance, German girls, is that they are almost entirely unable and unwilling to give up methods of work inherited or once learned in favor of more efficient ones, to adapt themselves to new methods, to learn and to concentrate their intelligence, or even to use it at all. Oh, this is great. Explanations of the possibility of making work easier, above all, more profitable to themselves, generally encounter a complete lack of understanding. Increases of piece rates are without avail against the stone wall of habit. In general, it is otherwise, and that is a point of no little importance from our point of view. Only with girls having a specifically religious, especially a pietistic background. One often hears statistical investigation confirms it that by far the best chances of economic education are found among this group. If you read that paragraph about how women don't appreciate the importance of the spirit of capitalism, or always content to do things as they always do, and they resist change, what would you think if you were Marx? How would Marx interpret this traditionalist behavior on the part of workers? How would Marx, Kristen?
Resistance, right? It's not necessarily that they're just stubborn and don't want to be efficient, it's that they're actively resistant.
Yes. Yes. You know, if you're in a piece rate system and suddenly, you know, you don't want to work hard. Because if you work hard in a piece rate system, what happens? If you work hard on a piece rate system, what happens? What do capitalists do to you? They cut your rates, and so you actually earn less money for the same amount of work. So there are all sorts of reasons why workers in a capitalist relationship would not want to change things, because those change, as we know from Marx, leads to what? Leads to more exploitation. So yes, indeed, this so-called resistance by women workers suggested they may well have very advanced class consciousness. Anyway, that's not Weber's point. Weber's point is that they are not imbued with the spirit of capitalism, and that he finds this evidence all over society, particularly amongst those who are embedded in pre-capitalist, we would call modes of production, pre-capitalist economic systems, who find this traditionalism. And so the acquisitiveness, the acquisitive instinct, the desire to consume, and the traditionalists go together, and they are in opposition to the spirit of capitalism. They are in opposition to the spirit of capitalism. The spirit of capitalism is what pushes people to actually pursue change and transformation, to conserve energy, to innovate. Yes, Lars?
So he says that modern societies are based on the spirit of capitalism.
Ah, no, we haven't got to modern. He's saying, look, you know, this is... He's trying to look at the origins of this modern Western bourgeois racial capitalism. And one key element of it in the beginning was the spirit of capitalism. We're going to have to ask the question, or you're going to have to ask the question as you go home and read these texts, you're going to ask, what happens to this spirit of capitalism over time? But he's talking about the origins at the moment. Okay? Because I think if you look around, I mean, what do you think? What do you think about modern capitalism? Is it imbued with the spirit of capitalism? Lars?
I think we're going back to the traditional. I mean, I think most people only work, or I don't know, maybe not in this country, but most of the other places.
Ah, yes, the welfare state of Norway.
No, I mean, it's not the point to work more than absolutely necessary. I
mean, that's the welfare state, you know, it supports you, you don't have to work more. If you don't work, you're supported by the state, right? That's what you're saying?
No, but I mean, you only work, if you have a certain lifestyle and you know how much money, I mean, I have a certain lifestyle and I know how much money I need to live a life like that.
And that's it.
I only find a way to get so much money, and when I get so much money,
Of course you don't work more. This is whole totally irrational, just what Weber would say. Very good. Yes. Matthew?
Well, in response to that, I was raised in kind of this way that Weber is describing. So I would say that it's very much still around, and I wouldn't say it's necessarily going away.
You are the... I mean, you know, you may be just very exceptional.
Maybe, I don't know.
What do people think about this question? Yes, Jessica?
Doesn't it also kind of depend on the class that you're in? Like, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, like, you're not going to think about making money for more money. You're thinking about, you know, paying your credit card bills and your rent and how I'm going to pay for my next meal, and not about what's in my savings account right now.
Right. That's very good. So let's differentiate this by class. Indeed, no, it's very difficult for some people to be imbued with the spirit of capitalism if they are part of the exploited class. Yes, indeed. But what about the capitalist class? Can we say the capitalist class in this country is imbued with the spirit of capitalism?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. You think it is, huh? Yeah. Aaron.
Well, there's a sort of Yahoo example of Warren Buffett buying his home in the 1950s for $31,000 as an example of his frugality. Nobody's the world's most wealthiest man. But I think the fact that it's such a piece of triviality is because it's so exceptional.
Any thoughts about this? Any thoughts about the character of the capitalist class in the modern United States of America? Sasha? Not Sasha, is it? No, because you're shifting me around on me now. Hold on. No, you're Courtney.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm
Andy and Sasha.
Hmm?
I can be Andy and Sasha.
Yes, you see, yeah, because I thought you were a Sasha with a hair back, but I guess you're not. You're Courtney with the hair back. Okay, right, I'm listening.
I was going to say it's kind of ironic now because I feel like there's this whole idea of like, the American dream and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and spirit of capitalism, but then with the economic crisis, it's kind of like these big, you know, auto companies and these big corporations are asking for handouts, which kind of goes back to like a socialist model. So I think it's kind of ironic that
right, handouts are, you know, they would really contravene the precepts of Benjamin Franklin, right? Yes, Mari.
Like, I think what you were saying about Warren Buffett is really interesting because he's like, was like a huge supporter of Obama, who was like for increasing taxes. So like, it goes with that, like, it's not necessarily been about money, but like the idea behind the work ethic.
Right, it's methodical control of your life.
Right, like it like represents, like it speaks for you as an individual.
Right. Right, the question is that work ethic still around? I mean, Weber's saying that it was necessary to get capitalism going, but once capitalism going, does the work ethic disappear? Is it around, as Neil?
I would say the ethic that Weber's talking about, that spirit of capitalism got us into this mess, and the reason that Americans are confident that it will get us out of it is because that ethic is still there. The spirit of capitalism will cause...
How did the spirit of capitalism get us into this mess?
Well, without certain amounts of regulation, people's pursuit of more and more money for the sake of having it caused them to kind of circumvent.
Very good, very good, very good.
The reason people know that it'll
people were obsessively pursuing money.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to kind of...
And took enormous risks.
Yes.
Handed out loans to people who they knew couldn't pay them.
One of the things, yes.
Yes.
But I think we know that people are going to want to pursue more and more money, and so there'll be some guy that's graduating from business school now that'll come up with something, and he'll pursue a lot of money, create a lot of jobs, and then we'll eventually get out of this. So I think the spirit of capitalism is definitely still here, because that's what will bounce us back.
Very interesting. Yes. Who are you? Who are you? Can you tell me who you are?
Oh, Aaron.
Aaron.
Yes, Aaron Judah.
Aaron, too. Carbon copy, yes, go on.
Thinking about this, like, on an individual level, the spirit of capitalism, like, I was thinking about contemporary examples and kind of considering, like, the Bernie Madoff situation. And as much as Bernie Madoff was the bad guy in that, you also have to consider, like, what did the spirit of capitalism do to the people who invested aggressively with Bernie Madoff and put all this money in that could have probably done a lot more securely and maintained whatever their current living situation was in their retirement instead of now protesting outside of this, you know.
So what's your conclusion? Were they imbued with the spirit of capitalism and this was their downfall?
Right.
This is what? Too much spirit of capitalism in this country, huh? That's interesting. That's interesting. Yes, Monica?
It's kind of like a very capitalism. So what I got from like the Benjamin Franklin side of it was like, it's hard work and diligence in your life. And I don't know if you guys remember read the book Rachel and Dying, which talks about like hard, like she has a PhD in biology and she's working out with basically identities and how that's like the hardest work she's ever done. But like we don't value that as much in society. And those people are working harder than like Bernie Madoff, who I don't know, I feel like in 2020 on it, but she was like off in vacation and like leaving it around to his son.
Yes, there was a high level of consumption in his life.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if that's like, if that fits with the process.
Yeah, very interesting questions, yes. I got 5 minutes in which to do the rationalization of religion. You should take these questions in your head, take them to your sections, take them home, but I am going to move on here. Okay, what we have said so far is there is a spirit of capitalism which Weber is saying is unique unique. It appears, you know, in the backwoods of Pennsylvania, right? In the 16th century, 17th century. Not in the heart of capitalism in Italy, but in the backwoods. What is this spirit of capitalism? Well, he defines it, and he wants to know where it comes from. He's going to look at the religious antecedents of the spirit of capitalism. So what are these religious antecedents? Well, we have to understand then the big picture of Weber's understanding and theory of religion, and which is actually difficult to do in 3 minutes. Look, Weber starts out with a premise. On page 155, he starts out with a premise. He starts out with a premise that on 2, 4, 5, 6 lines from the top on page 155, and you should read it, that essentially, well, he says, for in a time in which the beyond meant everything, when the social position of the Christian depended upon his admission to communion, the clergyman, through his ministry, church discipline and preaching exercised an influence which we modern men are entirely unable to picture. In such a time, the religious forces which express themselves through such channels are the decisive influences in the formation of national character. What he's saying here is we have got to imagine a situation in which religion is so central and crucial to everybody's life. That, and in particular, people were obsessed about the life beyond. What will happen to us after we die? And religion gave them an understanding of what would happen to them after they die. And what he's concerned with, what he calls salvation religions, in which it is our activity, our practices, our conduct in life on earth that will shape what will happen to us in the life beyond. And this is in contrast to the idea of magic. Magic, when one thinks about magic, or one thinks about oracles, one thinks about fortune telling, one thinks about cards, one thinks about astrology as telling you what's going to happen to you in the future. Your fate is defined in some arbitrary way by things that you do not control. That is magic. But what Weber is concerned with is religions of a salvationist character in which the activity, conduct on earth will actually shape what one happens to one's in one's afterlife. And what he argues is that the salvationist religions can be divided more or less into two types. Those in which that sort of endorse a passive relationship to the world. And he's thinking here about Hinduism and Buddhism. As what passive relationship to the world will in fact lead to certain sort of fatalistic consequences in the life afterwards. And a more activist orientation to the world. And the Judeo-Christian tradition of religion for Weber was actually the tradition of religion that led people to actively participate in the world in order to assure themselves a life of being saved afterwards. So the point of this Judeo-Christian religious tradition is that it led to activist conduct in the world. Now, what he's going to do, and this is a story and you will have to read about it, it goes like this. That we go from magic to salvation religions, and here he's particularly interested in Christianity, and here then he sees the way that Catholicism, the early form of Christianity, gives rise to, under the Reformation, to Protestantism. And how under Protestantism we go from Luther, to Calvin. This is the logic of his argument, and he's going to suggest that this
progression from Catholicism to Protestantism and then from Lutheranism to Calvinism involves the increasingly intense regulation of one's life on earth. And what he's going to argue is that associated with the idea of Protestant Lutheranism is the idea of what? Of calling. People have a calling on earth, a place in the division of labor, if you will, that God has assigned them. But they accept that passively. Whereas Calvinism believes in the concept of predestination. And predestination means what? It means that you are predestined to be saved or damned. Elect or damned, and you do not know it. And you are as nervous as hell about it. You are nervous. You do not know whether you're saved or you're damned. And so what do? If you're nervous about that, you do what? You look for signs that you are saved. And you will see those signs in the consequences of your conduct on earth. And you're so nervous that you get so intensely involved in your life that you begin to methodically control every moment of that life. And you actually develop, if you're a capitalist, that spirit of capitalism. That is the argument of the book. And we will go over it on Thursday. So read, read, and reread. Oh, shoot. Yes, Conrad.
People that are under Christianity, Pentecostal, apostolic, doctrines like that, where would that fall?
They're forms of Protestantism.
That's a form of Protestantism?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and the question is whether they have the Protestant ethic, whether that is indeed a part of their...
Because that's a tradition that I was growing up in. Uh-huh. And a lot of that, of what you were saying, is so evident with, just what you were saying even at the end about Calvinism, where it's you don't know whether or not, you know what I mean?
You're saved or damned. It's a very Protestant...
Hearing that, it resonated with me.